Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, Professor Doug Becker is our guest host. He will be speaking with Nick Cole about his new book, Public Diplomacy, Foundation for Global Engagement in the Digital Age. But first, how immigration could lead to greater democratization in the world. It depends where the migrants go, says our next guest. Margaret Peters is a professor of political science at the University of California, Los Angeles, the author of Trading Barriers, Immigration and the Remaking of Globalization, and co-author of Restraining the Huddled Masses, Migration Policy and Autocratic Survival.
Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Margaret Peters. It's great to have you here with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to talk to you about this research you've done. You and your co-author have been looking at immigration, migration really, and how it affects democratization. And it was kind of fascinating to think that where somebody goes has an effect on the home country. Can you walk us through those findings?
Sure. So what we find in the paper is that when migrants from authoritarian countries, so countries run by dictators, countries run by the military, countries run by political parties like the Communist Party, where they don't have free and fair elections, when they go to democracies, we find that then they spread the norms of democracy back home, and this leads to greater democratization at home. And so what we think is going on is that, and there's a fair amount of literature in sociology and political science that set this on a more case-by-case example, is that when migrants come to a country like the U.S. or go to countries in the EU from authoritarian countries, they learn just sort of about everyday politics and life in a democracy. So they might be learning like, hey, a cop stops me but doesn't ask me for a bribe. That's different. Or they might, you know, if they send their kids to school, they might say like, oh, it's okay in the U.S. to challenge the principal or challenge the teacher, whomever the authority figure is, on something that's going on. That's not what happens in my country. Or they might think, look at things like the free press and learn about their home country, or just learn about how politics happens in a democracy. So there's all these different opportunities for learning about political life that's very different from their life at home, which then they can either tell their friends and families about, or they might return home with that knowledge.
Maybe an example or two would actually show when you have immigrants moving to, say, a European country, where have you seen greater democratization happening?
One of the best examples of this is probably in Mexico, coming to the United States. So there's a fair amount of research showing that the migrants who came to the United States under the Farm Workers Program learned a lot about democracy in the U.S. And during that time period, Mexico was an autocracy. It was run by the PRI, or the, what's known as the PRI party. And they learned a lot about democracy and how what the PRI was doing was, even though it held elections, was not really democracy. And so they helped become a constituency for Democratic parties, and especially for this one party, the PRD, which is more of a leftist party, or a more sort of center-left party. And when we saw greater support for the PRD, and especially in 94, when we had more of free election happen in Mexico, these areas with migrants were greater supporters for democratic change. So it helps sort of state this constituency for democracy.
Have you seen that go in other directions as well?
We can see some of that happening in places around the Arab Spring. So one of the interesting sort of correlations that are out there, and we're still working on nailing down that this has in fact happened directly, is that you had the Great Recession happen in 2008. And this meant that a lot of people who used to go from North Africa or the Middle East to Europe could no longer go to Europe because there were no longer jobs in Europe to go to. There were stronger border enforcement. There were fewer visas to get. And so people who had been going back and forth or who had been planning to go to Europe suddenly were stuck at home. And so a lot of these younger folks who maybe had been going to Europe for work and were now stuck at home and were part of the protest. And while that did not lead in all cases, it really only led to full democratization in the case of Tunisia, you saw a lot of support in the region from people who were former migrants to Europe or who had family members in Europe and had learned, you know, what was going on in Europe and how political life was different there.
Was there a role at all with the Global Compact?
Well, the Global Compact is sort of still in the beginning stages of discussion. I would like to see a larger role for these sorts of discussions of politics in things like the Global Compact, or, you know, like the World Bank talks a lot about, you know, the importance of migration on development, but rarely ever talks about its role in political development and the role that migrants can play spreading these norms of democracy, which, you know, is frustrating because, you know, they're always focusing on economic development and they talk about how politics is very important for economic development and we have to get the right sort of institutions. So to sort of be ignoring this channel is frustrating as a scholar.
Well, this is the first time we've really even heard the words Global Compact around these issues. And my wonder is, this is an awareness that is growing to some degree that we're going to have these conversations. The question is related to both these discussions that happen on a global level, whether or not they come to full implementation, and an effect at all on issues of democratization.
I think it's great that people are hearing more about it. And I think where we could maybe get more buy-in and more support. So the U.S. is totally out of the Global Compact at this point.
Yeah.
So that they're not going to participate. But you look at places where you have more openness to the ideas of a Global Compact. So you think about like Canada, maybe Australia, maybe New Zealand, and those smaller, you know, Scandinavian countries, the smaller powers that, you know, I think that getting this idea that democratization, that migrants can help spread democracy and that, you know, this will be good for the world in general, because we think that having greater democracy and greater freedom is good for peace. You know, democracies don't go to war with each other, all of those sorts of good things. I think that could become part of the discussion about the Global Compact and maybe help think about maybe these states should have more regularized, you know, labor programs where, you know, workers can come from authoritarian countries and work and earn money and help their families back home, but also come and learn about democracy while abroad. And that don't just want, you know, right now so many labor migrants are going to places like the Persian Gulf, they're going to Russia, they're going to Singapore, countries that are extremely not democratic. And while they're earning a lot of money and this is helping their family back home and that's good for the migrants and their families, it's not necessarily good for their country. Because another finding that we have in the paper is that when migrants go to other autocracies, so when they go to the Persian Gulf, go to Singapore, you know, they're sending back money home. And they're leaving the country and taking out some of the energy maybe for political opposition. And the money they're sending back is sort of being misattributed to the leaders. In all places, at all times, as Bill Clinton said, it's the economy, stupid. So when people's economy, personal economy is doing well, they tend to support the leader regardless of who the leader is. And so by having people just go to places like them, having the only opportunity to go to places like the Persian Gulf means that your migration is actually bolstering authoritarianism. Whereas if they can come to Western consolidated democracies, that could actually lead to greater democratization.
And you've also said that it leads to democratization in a sort of cheap way.
Right. So not only a cheap way, but, you know, you can think about it. We actually, if you think about like the GDP being, you know, making money, we actually in the developed world make money or increase our GDP when we bring in more immigrants. So just by having more workers around, we can produce more stuff. There's not much evidence that especially low-skill workers from developing countries are really labor market threats to natives. In fact, there's a lot of evidence that they complement natives in the developed world. And so you can sort of like do democracy promotion on the cheap, or even as I jokingly say, make money off of it without concerns of real economic harm to your native population.
And also you have found the relationship between trade and immigration. How do you see this?
Yeah, so that's in my first book, the stuff on migration and democratization will hopefully be my second book, Trading Barriers, Immigration, the Remaking of Globalization. And there I find that there's this really robust negative relationship between open borders, between trade and migration. And so what has happened as we've opened our country and most of the developed world to more and more trade in goods. So think about all those like products we get it from China or from elsewhere in the developing world. That leads to the closure of low skill intensive businesses or businesses that use a lot of low skill labor here in the United States and in Europe. And when those businesses close, they no longer support open immigration. They were once the major employers of immigration, of immigrant workers. And once they close, they no longer support immigration and provide that political support. So to give you an example, textiles here in the United States, where I'm located, used to be a major employer of immigrant labor. And the textile industry has shrunk in size and has become much more capital intensive in the U.S. and just doesn't even lobby for immigration any longer, where they used to be a major industry player in lobbying for immigration. So you see this sort of differences between trade having this effect. As we open trade more, there's less industry support for immigration, which makes it all the much harder then to like have these good benefits, migration on democratization.
Well, Margaret Peters, thank you so much for joining us.
You're so welcome. Thank you so much for this opportunity to talk about my work.
Margaret Peters is a professor of political science at the University of California, Los Angeles, the author of Trading Barriers, Immigration and the Remaking of Globalization, and co-author of Restraining the Huddled Masses, Migration Policy and Autocratic Survival.
When we come back, how is new technology changing public diplomacy? Stay tuned. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Professor Doug Becker is our guest host. Unlike traditional diplomacy, practiced between formal diplomats, public diplomacy focuses on everyday citizens. Today's panel lays the foundations of public diplomacy, its techniques, and its effectiveness. It then examines the role of new technology in the digital age and how that poses new challenges and opportunities.
I'm Doug Becker. Today we are discussing public diplomacy, a field of study that combines communications, international relations, and public opinion. While it has a long history, the study is increasingly salient in an age of globalization. Our focus today is Nick Kull's new book, Public Diplomacy: Foundations for a Global Engagement in the Digital Age. Nick Kull is professor of communication and director of the Public Diplomacy Program at the University of Southern California. He is author of numerous books and articles, and notably the very recently published Public Diplomacy: Foundations for a Global Engagement in the Digital Age. Daniel Aguirre Azucar is assistant professor at Universidad del Desarrollo in Santiago, Chile. He has written Public Diplomacy in Latin America, an Emerging Field of Practice. We will start with you, Nick. The book lays out the foundations for public diplomacy. What exactly is public diplomacy? What is the concept behind it? What does it entail?
Well, Doug, the core concept of public diplomacy is that it is the way in which international actors advance their foreign policy, not by engaging one another, but by engaging with a foreign public. It's the communication component of foreign policy. But the obvious counter question to that is, but how is that different from propaganda? And that's really what the book is about, the way in which it's possible to imagine a way of bringing publics into foreign policy that is not about just smacking them over the head with information until at some imagined point they see the world your way.
And so is it fair to say that public diplomacy is more about dialogue rather than just delivering a message? Is that one of the fundamental differences?
Absolutely. And public diplomacy begins with listening, and it advances through dialogue, and that to do public diplomacy properly, you have to be open to being changed by whoever you're interacting with. You know, this is the big difference between public diplomacy and propaganda. A propagandist is never open to being changed by the person that they're addressing or the people they're addressing. Whereas in public diplomacy, that has to be not just a possibility, but maybe even a probability. And that's why, you know, we think about public diplomacy as being based on relationships. As soon as you start talking about relationships and thinking about a relationship, then necessarily it's going to be based on dialogue and not just one person doing all the talking.
And Daniel, I know that definitions of public diplomacy will sometimes differ in different countries and different regions. Is that your understanding of public diplomacy, or in what ways do you see public diplomacy a bit differently than, say, Americans do?
Nick, congratulations on your book once again. Yes, for the most part, the general understanding of public diplomacy has to do with this engagement, the idea of engaging with foreign publics, and not necessarily just being of the nature of sending out one-way messaging or pushing out information in a way to try to convince others, but not necessarily engaging in any type of or interacting in any type of relationship building for mutual understanding. That's what we're trying to actually talk about in Latin America, the region where I work, in which primarily what is seen interchangeably with the notion of public diplomacy is something much more similar to nation branding or place branding. And that in and of itself is not necessarily as problematic as we could have thought of in the past, but it does make it more focused on the commercial side or the business side of really reaching out to foreign publics. So in Latin America, at least, and I would even venture to say in parts of the developing world, there seems to be more of a focus on that part of public diplomacy, which is closer to nation or place branding.
To be honest, Doug, that's partly why I wrote the book, to try and rescue the concept of public diplomacy from just being about persuading people stuff and to try and move it towards a kind of a more dialogue-focused practice. I see that the idea of just using public diplomacy to get people as a form of public relations, if you like, if you're just using it to try and persuade somebody that you're the greatest, this is limited. So I see it not as so much as a tool to persuade people that you're the greatest, but as a mechanism by which you and whoever you're communicating with can be mutually greater. It's a difference there, but I agree with what Daniel's saying about how it's seen in Latin America. And that's absolutely what I'm trying to do with the book, is to find ways of moving beyond that narrower conception, especially around nation branding, and to say, well, let's work out something more complex, but for the mutual benefit.
So this concept of public diplomacy seems to focus on cooperation and on the relationship between the two states. And my own background in international relations, I think of there's two issues here. One is how much of public diplomacy is about building cooperation versus competition, or is public diplomacy, is it competitive by any means? Daniel?
Following what Nick has proposed in his works and in the book itself, I would see it more of a cooperative approach towards others. It's highly normative in that sense, if you want to look at it that way from an international relations standpoint. It looks to build relationships. It looks to build profound relationships of cooperation that can lead to pursuing global issues such as environmental climate change or human rights issues. I think that's really the high point of and the differentiator of public diplomacy in terms of other types of international engagement is this this appeal towards cooperation, this actual aim towards cooperation in the long run, which is what is used in the terminology as mutual understanding.
Absolutely. Yeah. I agree with that.
And Nick, I'm struck by, in the organization of your book, you've got five foundational elements of public diplomacy. You know, for the audience, those elements are listening, advocacy, cultural diplomacy, exchange diplomacy, and international broadcasting. And we'll get into all of those. But the first question I'm really struck by is, as you list those, you seem to prioritize listening as one of the fundamental, maybe the most important, or at least first step in public diplomacy. Why is, you know, listening more important than advocacy, for example?
I think that listening should be essential to any effective communication. And it has astonished me while I've been talking publicly about this to people in government, which is now over the last 15 years, it's astonished me that people need to write that down when I say, oh, if you're planning to communicate, listen first. You'd think people didn't have mothers. And of course, people are completely aware that you need to listen before you communicate. But the problem is that with government communication, there's a kind of a self-confidence and an inflexibility about what is to be communicated that limits openness to listening. In U.S. public diplomacy, it often feels that the Congress wants people to go out and say, the answer's America, now what's the question? And that's no way to build a relationship. It's no way to promote a healthy international situation. Sure, you need to know who you are, but you also need to know who you are in relation to other people and have a sense of who those other people are. And I found in my research, there are lots of examples of countries trying to communicate or communicating something that's important to themselves without realizing, for example, that what they're saying is of no interest to other countries and that they're really wasting their time. They may feel better about it for having shared something super important, like their calligraphy in their particular national writing script. But if other people can't read that writing, they're not going to find calligraphy to be interesting. And you'd be amazed how often there are very, very idiosyncratic cultural, diplomatic, or similar things done overseas that really are of no interest to foreign audiences. It's little things like that that are illustrative of failure to listen, right the way up to the really big things where nation states create entire advocacy campaigns to answer questions that nobody's asking. And the best example of that would be a campaign that the last Bush administration did. This would be immediately after 9/11, called Shared Values. The Shared Values campaign was designed to persuade Muslim audiences that there were lots of happy Muslims living within the United States. The problem was that wasn't where international Islamic distrust of the United States was coming from. That was more likely to be based on a fairly well-informed judgment of American foreign policy, its support for Saudi Arabia, support for Israel, and presence in the Middle East with troops, not on any idea that it was horrible to be a Muslim in Dearborn, Michigan. People weren't interested in that question, and many people were well aware that it was quite nice to live in the United States, and the United States was, at some level, fairly religiously tolerant. So it didn't make any sense to spend money, millions and millions of dollars, in fact, answering a question that nobody was asking. If they'd listened first, they wouldn't have gone all the way up that, what turned out to be a blind alley.
Daniel, your thoughts on listening?
Well, the thing is that what Nick says is exactly what should be looked at and considered when you're thinking about campaigns and international engagement campaigns on the operational level in terms of defining baseline goals, objectives, and then basically evaluating if what you're doing is actually moving the needle or having an impact. And that's something that seems obvious, but apparently in many of these campaigns and many of these programs, there is this idea or this notion that listening will come by inertia or is something that doesn't have to be planned into incorporated into some type of strategy. So listening in terms of how Nick proposes it in his book and his work and his body of work has much to do with a starting point, midway point, towards the end, evaluating if everything that you've done in terms of public diplomacy had an impact. When you think about this more concretely, when it comes to the states, thinking about exactly what others are, the public opinion on a global scale is really thinking about in terms of salient, important topics, governments, nation states have to really be scanning the environment to figure out what are the important issues. And listening is key to that. It is key to building these relationships and making profound relationships and really pursuing these global issues such as climate change, for example.
I know that one of the foundational theoretical arguments about public diplomacy is Joseph Nye's concept of soft power. And the way we in international relations define soft powers, there's numerous variations of it, but typically the power of being attractive, making your policies or your country more attractive. Is that your understanding of soft power, and how much should we view public diplomacy through that lens of projecting power, but a kind of softer, more cooperative power. Nick?
Well, I think there's two things there, that I do believe that there's an emerging cooperative form of power where your willingness to be part of a collective solution to a problem will be part of how your country is evaluated by international audiences. And that countries that fail to cooperate and fail to be part of collective solutions will be negatively impacted by that. So that's the first thing. In more detail, I think that I see public diplomacy as being a way in which soft power can be harnessed or enhanced. It's not the same thing as soft power, because soft power is a quality that exists, a quality of admiration that exists in the mind of an audience. And you can tell that audience new things to encourage them to be admiring. You can remind them of things that you've done in the past to sustain their admiration, but you can't really create admiration where none is deserving. And to me, the bottom line of issues around soft power and reputation is this, that if you want a good reputation, then you should do good stuff, and do not just good stuff, but relevant good stuff. And the countries that have the best reputations are the countries that have done the best stuff most widely in the world for the longest period of time. And an emerging country that wants a good reputation should start thinking about doing good stuff. And it's interesting to me to see how there are now successful strategies for newer, smaller countries that are developing strong reputations by being important in relevant fields. Singapore is a good example of that, I think.
Daniel, your thoughts on soft power?
Soft power is a key element, or is a key part to consider in terms of actually putting into effect or implementing public diplomacy. It is indeed something that has to do with each country's assets, political, cultural, and other values that they project in certain ways into the world and to the public opinion. But I do have to say that as of late, there has been some level of criticism towards soft power, and people are starting to look, some scholars are starting to look to new forms of projecting the international images, such as strategic narratives, which indeed are similar, but reflect upon more on longer histories of countries and their contribution and their roles in the international system. Soft power, again, is relevant, of course. It continues to be relevant. However, there is this notion of soft power. To what extent can we measure that? To what extent can soft power be constructed is really difficult to really think about and to really ascertain if that's true. What's being seen is that countries are trying to lead certain issue areas. These issue areas are trying to be leaders, and smaller countries are being able to transform their role or to portray a certain role, a newer role in the international system that follows more of the lines of this bigger narrative that has to do with this approach that I'm talking about, which is the strategic narrative.
Absolutely, Nick?
Well, I agree with that. And I would also say that one of the ways in which soft power has gone wrong is not in the theory, but in the discussion, and that is that it's seen as being a luxury of the wealthiest, most significant countries. Mm-hmm. And I think that instead of thinking about the soft power of the really attractive and famous countries, we should think at the other end of the scale about countries that are vulnerable being known for something, so that when things go wrong, they aren't overwhelmed. And a good example of a country that didn't have soft power and that suffered is Ukraine. I think if Ukraine had been better known and had a better moral reputation, it would have fared much better when it came under threat during the crisis of 2014. And that's why I'm starting to think not about soft power, but about reputational security, the idea that there's a quality of security that comes from having a good reputation, and that the way to develop that reputation is by being seen as a good country, not just for having a nice culture, being a good place to go on holiday, but also for being a moral country that keeps to standards of human rights and is a part of collective solutions. So even a relatively powerless country could, by being part of a bigger cooperation, having a more widely seen cultural contribution, be appreciated over and above its hard power categories. So I think that there's still a lot to talk about around issues of reputation, narrative, soft power. This is all a really important thing to move forward.
Nick, that concept of reputational security was particularly fascinating in the book. In particular, you know, to interject a little bit of my own research in historical memory, we have a concept that we call mnemonic security, the security of your memories and the security of your narratives, which seems to fit quite well with what Daniel is saying is about a strategic, the importance of strategic narratives as much as anything else. But one of the challenges when thinking of strategic narratives, of reputational security, and of memory security is the relationship between your domestic audience and your international audience. One of your lessons was, this is not for domestic consumption. This is for an international consumption. Right. And the kinds of narratives that you present to an international audience is very different than your own domestic audience. How difficult is that, though, considering that the world in the digital age is so much more connected that whatever you put out to an international audience is going to be reflected back to your domestic audience?
Oh, absolutely. This is a tremendous problem. But we have to be aware that the problem isn't little bits of public diplomacy leaching back into the domestic market. The problem is public diplomacy being run principally to leach back into the domestic market, that people are paying more attention to their international, to sort of the domestic exposure to international performance than they are to really trying to engage foreigners. So that's the first thing I'd say about that, is that the reason I'm concerned about this domestic priority thing is because it's supplanting public diplomacy in some places. And the second thing is that sometimes the domestic audience is the liability. Countries have to realize that the attitudes of their least globally connected citizens might well undermine the claim to be a global country. Now, sometimes this comes up with the United States and international dislike of some kinds of Americanness, a sort of hardline nativist in the past, you know, segregationist, white supremacist attitudes you can find in some places in the United States. But maybe it's easier to talk about the problem in Korea. In Korea, South Korea, you have a very globally oriented government. But as soon as you go down to look at the South Korean public, you find they're not actually that interested in foreigners. They don't want to learn foreign languages. They want to get married to somebody from their own province. They're not even interested that much in connecting to other Koreans. And the Korean Presidential Commission on Nation Branding recognized that one of their major tasks was going to be to prepare South Korea for a global role. And you can't just change things at the top. You have to really seek to open the entire society to international relationships. And this has happened in Europe since World War II through twinning of cities, through civic engagement programs, school exchanges, a whole host of bottom-up exchange diplomacy. And in universities, we have this amazing thing in Europe called the Erasmus program that allows students to spend semesters on one another's countries. Those sorts of grassroots things that really, I think, go a long way to begin changing underlying attitudes. So we need to be careful, to sum up, going into our public diplomacy relationships, that we're not undermining our claims because of the way that our country is, or the way we're not let down by our own attitudes within our own population.
And Daniel, do you see some of the same issues in Latin America?
I do. It's very interesting. The second part of what Nick was describing really brings to mind some of the lack of a real international exposure to at the civil society level in Latin America. It's growing. It's increasing. But the reality is that there is a lot of still a ton of anti-immigration sentiment, anti-foreigner sentiment that is recently being actually activated once again with different migration groups, populations of migrants coming into to different parts of Latin America. You're thinking about the Venezuelan crisis, of course. We're thinking about some of the countries that received some of the Haitian migrants, primarily here in Chile and in other parts. That still kind of undermines, it completely undermines this notion of trying to be a responsible global actor taking on a role, a leadership role in these issues. As soon as the public perception inside the countries feel completely threatened by foreigners in the country. So indeed, it's a difficult line to actually to be on a trapeze or to be on a tightrope, because you can definitely fall off if you are not really considering that what you're saying outward has to really think about or consider domestic public, but in a way that doesn't really activate or make them really create a backlash towards what you're saying internationally. And that's because, like I said, the level of internationalization of Latin American society is, for the most part, is still very, very nascent. It's still very, very new in the last couple of decades.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We are discussing Nick Kull's new book, Public Diplomacy, Foundations for Global Engagement in the Digital Age, with Nick Kull from the University of Southern California and Daniel Aguirre Azocar from Universidad del Desarrollo in Santiago. Thus far, we've been talking a great deal about societal elements, about how certain countries, how certain populations will address international pressures or international experiences, etc. How much is public diplomacy, though, also tied pretty directly to advocacy for a government policy? Because I think of when public diplomacy first sort of made its way into public discourse in the United States, it was the naming of Karen Hughes as the Assistant Secretary for Public Diplomacy. But the whole idea was that it was tied to trying to sell the U.S. policy of invading Iraq to the Arab people. Is that, I suspect you think that's a narrow view of it, but still, how important is the selling of, or, you know, the advocacy for a policy, and how problematic can that be?
There's a reason why there's a chapter in the book on advocacy, but there's also a reason why it's only one chapter. Advocacy is an important component of public diplomacy. The problem is that for some observers, it's the only part of public diplomacy that they think is worthwhile. That there's a general attitude, especially among Congress, I think, that public diplomacy is for persuading people. And I think the advocacy component is the element of public diplomacy which is most similar to propaganda. But my feeling is that for reasons of credibility and just for, you know, breadth of knowledge, to be credible, to be effective in advocacy, it's better done cooperatively than in a one-man show. I think that the strange thing about public diplomacy, when you study it, is that while the legislatures expect something that's based on advocacy, the practitioners themselves understand the value of this two-way business, that it's more about promoting mutual understanding. However, those same practitioners, when they're talking to Congress or to the legislature, they will express what they want to do in terms of advocacy and persuasion as if what they're talking about is propaganda. So the same people will have two ways of talking about their work. They'll have an inside understanding and then an outside understanding. And this makes it quite difficult to study public diplomacy because the same people will have two different ways of talking. And I feel that practitioners have learned not to be honest about the level to which they wish to learn from foreigners, because certainly in the United States and in other large countries in the world, people don't get elected for saying we need to learn from foreigners. But everybody in the, well, to say everybody, most people I know who are public diplomats would absolutely see the country as having a lot to learn from contact with international opinion and international voices.
I know that's a significant challenge for U.S. foreign policy. And I know in Latin America in particular, one of the key challenges that U.S. diplomats now face is American policy vis-a-vis Venezuela, in particular with the U.S. history, with regimes, with desires for regime change or toppling leaders, etc. How difficult has this been for the U.S. in Latin America? And if you had any advice for the Americans from a Latin American perspective, what would that advice be?
What I've been looking at, of course, you know, the history of interventions in Latin America is still very fresh in the minds of Latin American society, opinion leaders, governmental leaders, party leaders, et cetera. The reality of of actually trying to advocate change, regime change in places such as Venezuela has meant that the U.S. has had to try to take a step back. What we've noticed, if they publicly and in media broadcasts or when an official such as Pompeo visits Latin America, signal that there's an issue there with Venezuela, the reality is that there's also seeking out partnerships with some other leaders in the region, and that's something that speaks to partnerships, which is something that Nick has in his book as well. However, there's always this looming presence or this suspicion that the U.S. is behind certain coalitions of Latin American leaders or Latin American countries trying to push forward a democratic transition in that country. I speak of primarily there's this group which is called the Grupo de Lima, the Lima Group, which is comprised of the Chilean government, of Chile, of Colombia, of Mexico, Paraguay, that has basically been trying for the last few months or even almost a year trying to push forward this regime change in Venezuela, and it hasn't been quite successful because of this looming idea in public opinion that there is definitely the U.S. has some type of interest in that group or influence in that group. So it's still quite troubling even for Latin American leaders who want to push that agenda to make it happen, because they're automatically linked to U.S. interests, or they're considered allies, they're considered individuals who are actually just furthering the U.S. agenda. And that's difficult. It's troublesome. You would think that Latin American voices can really push forward a democratic transition or call for a peaceful democratic transition in Venezuela.
So, Nick, is the challenge in Latin America trying to craft a public diplomacy campaign that would make the U.S. more attractive in Latin America, or is the challenge the policy the U.S. has chosen in Venezuela?
Oh, I think the challenge is for the United States to actually be more attractive to Latin America, to be more sensitive, to be less of a bully, and to acknowledge that it has a really difficult history in the region. I think the United States needs a lot more exchange with Latin America, that it's kind of gone from a European orientation to a Pacific orientation without really taking its Latin orientation seriously. And this is a big mistake. You know, we're now heading into the first presidential election in the United States where there are more Hispanic Americans than there are African Americans. But you do not see an adjustment in the domestic political scene. I mean, try looking at the Spanish language websites of American political candidates right now. A lot of them have been put through Google Translate and have these hilarious mistakes where idioms in English have been translated literally into Spanish and are completely hilarious. And I think this speaks to the Latin American problem of the United States, which is a century old at least, and has to be addressed. And the migration crisis is just the latest form of this difficulty.
I always hear that and think, if only there was an easy solution like hiring more native Spanish speakers on your campaign, rather than putting them through Google Translate.
Wherever would they find them?
Right? Yeah, exactly. Now, Daniel, you've focused your work quite a bit on the role of the digital revolution and its role in public diplomacy. What are some of the key ways that these new technologies are changing the practice of public diplomacy?
Well, the key ways, I would say conceptually, ideationally, what they are doing is making MFAs, Ministries of Foreign Affairs, really to rethink of what they're doing, to really open up, to really become more transparent, to really become more collaborative. Unfortunately, there is still a lag in terms of modernizing the diplomatic corps in Latin America. They are behind the curve on many of the more recent practices, and I'm talking about not necessarily using digital tools, but just the more open, transparent practices of diplomacy of our age. What the digital revolution has done is basically forced or actually put in their face the idea that, well, we really have to be online and we really need to answer questions. We really need to have some level of interaction with our own publics, but also with the foreign publics or even our own diaspora that's abroad. So that really makes them reconceptualize what is the role of a diplomat in this day and age, Latin American, South American diplomat. So in that sense, while I look at digital tools, how they use Twitter, how they use Facebook, or how they use WhatsApp, I'm really thinking about how this has affected the everyday practices and their notions of what it means to be a diplomat in this day and age. That's really how I am looking at it nowadays. So it's really about more of a normative and how also a functional way of operating that I see is at a critical point of shifting. But it hasn't shifted entirely yet. And that's the research that I am doing and keeping my eye out for, is to see where that's actually, there's actually a tipping point in this part of the world.
And Nick, despite the title of your book, mm-hmm. you immediately, you know, in the introduction declare that you're not separating out these new technologies from some of the more traditional practices of public diplomacy. Is that an indication that these new digital tools are just yet another tool in the toolbox that's not as transformative as perhaps some authors have suggested?
I think the jury has to be out on whether they're transformative. I believe they can certainly cause trouble. And we thought that technology was going to be the solution to public diplomacy terms. And now we're realizing that there are as many problems that come out of the technology as there are solutions. And as we go forward to negotiate this digital world, my point is that we shouldn't throw out the lessons of the analog past. And, you know, there are some pretty good takeaways from earlier eras of public diplomacy, guidelines as to good practice, and what worked in the past, I think will work in the present and in the future, because it's based on consistent human beings. So a lot of what I'm trying to do in the book is to talk about the foundations in behavioral psychology, effective messaging, all those sorts of things that work as well in a digital world as they worked in a world of sealing wax and people writing with quill pens and parchment.
Although I would imagine that tends to speed up messaging and...
For sure, but right. A bad message in the era of quill pens and parchment is a bad message, you know, and the qualities of bad messaging, qualities of good messaging remain, I think, consistent. And maybe what is different now is speed and ubiquity. And now we've got no choice but to put issues of public diplomacy at the center of international relations, because publics are at the center of international relations. But what you find, if you look at our field, is that that's not the way that people are thinking about it. They're thinking about things based on legacy influences. Something that was important to their supervisor's supervisor is still getting a lot of attention. And something that's important in the world, like our public opinion and mass communications, is marginal and is not getting the attention that it needs within academic circles. Policymakers are paying attention because they have to, but academics would rather keep on the same old conversations they've been having for donkey's years.
So a friend of mine published an op-ed, actually it was in the Hartford Courant, if you want to look it up, and it's entitled, Donald Trump Should Have Taken a Semester Abroad. The argument that American foreign policy, his view of the world, and just in general, the advancement of U.S. interests abroad are enhanced when the person delivering the message has studied abroad. And I imagine as well, you know, the notion of the exchange diplomacy. Mm-hmm. How important is the advancement? Because I know that semesters abroad, you mentioned, Nick, you mentioned the Erasmus program in Europe. How important is it that more and more people get abroad, study abroad, in particular those in those formative years, and ideally have positive experiences once they go abroad?
What we're looking at it is that Trump's marriages have been a one-man exchange program for supermodels. and so I don't think you can see him as entirely not participating in informal exchange. I don't see exchange, where I'm getting at is exchange isn't a it's not a magic bullet. Sometimes if you travel overseas, you're only there for there's a sort of a sweet spot. The quick visit can open you up to foreign influences. The long visit can help you really understand foreign ways of thinking. The medium-term visit, the visit that lasts for 3 months, can set you up to really dislike foreigners and to really enjoy and long for going back home. So I think that there are real questions around planning. There's a need to plan international exchanges. You can't just say that the semester abroad will magically make people sympathetic to foreign ways of thinking. Having said that, there does seem to be a certain broadening of the mind that comes through travel and international exposure. So, you know, of course, I would agree with that. I just don't think you can be as reductionist as to say, oh, if only Trump had a semester abroad or had traveled, he would see things differently. I am worried, though, how few people in the Senate have been overseas for any significant period of time. And that's really worrying because it used not to be the case. It used to be that people, especially in foreign relations work within the Senate, had a knowledge of the world. Now, the only person in modern Senate history to have spent a long time overseas on that committee was John McCain, who'd been there as a prisoner of war. There's a sort of absence of direct experience of international things that is a problem.
And Daniel, your thoughts on exchange?
Well, yeah, I would tend to agree with what Nick says. I mean, it isn't a magic bullet. However, it does seem to provide some more permanency in terms of forming more favorable opinions about the host country where you spent your time abroad. There has been some studies on this. And in terms of the time frame of how long the semester or a few months or a few weeks, that's something to be further analyzed. But overall, my impression is that, yes, it does provide some level of increased sensitivity at the least towards basically other cultures and other nations. But to say... Saying that, there's also individuals that might do the study abroad and not necessarily come back with the best of opinion of going abroad. They might also have to experience some type of crisis, political crisis, or they might just necessarily miss home, and that might just leave a really negative reminder of what being abroad meant. So yes, it depends on an individual basis, but I think on the collective or on a more aggregate level, it does seem to provide some level of more sensitivity among individuals who engage in exchanges.
So this is our last question. I'll ask Daniel first so we can give Nick the last word. Where do you see the future of public diplomacy? Do you see these kinds of practices as becoming more or less important or being transformed in some, you know, significant way? If you could put on that predictive hat and see, you know, if we were to have this conversation 10 years from now or 20 years from now, what do you imagine the main topics we would be discussing?
As I try to look at it from this point in history and maybe into the future, this point in our history, I really think that the necessity of public diplomacy is really evident. Ideally, it can try to really provide some type of solution to our most pressing issues on a global scale, but also to really try to keep at bay these visions of nationalistic and of populist views of the world that are not necessarily aiding in terms of sustaining this international society that we want to have. In that sense, I think that the necessity, the need of having public diplomacy present from now on to the future is clear to me. To the extent till governments will invest and keep on funding programs and strategies, that's where I'm still, at least in the short to midterm, I'm still pessimistic, with a little glimmer of hope, but still pessimistic in this really short term. So the call is to keep on fighting this notion of keeping public diplomacy present and part of foreign policy, not just bureaucracies, but also including individuals who could be those who engage in public diplomacy when there is none at the state level.
And Nick, your thoughts?
So the closing thought would be, I was struck by this thing that Simon Anholt, the British analyst, said in Mexico during the climate summit, where he said there's only one superpower left on the planet, and it is public opinion. Mm-hmm. And I think with this, the only way we don't experience public opinion as a superpower is because it's so subdivided. And if you can use public diplomacy to bring opinion together around important issues, you've got a method for dealing with the worst and the most intractable problems that we face. But I think what's important going forward is not only that we'll see public diplomacy as a central tool of the nation state, but that other actors are and will continue to step up and contribute to a much richer international dialogue and richer international, more productive international partnerships. So I'm thinking that we will see provinces and cities and non-governmental organizations all participating in public diplomacy, all reaching out, sharing stories, coming together around issues. And I think it's exciting, stimulating, and fundamentally, at the end of my book, I was hopeful about the future based on trends in public diplomacy. I think that once people start or connect to each other, that's the beginning of real solutions to the problems that just seem so so intractable as seen right now.
So the book is called Public Diplomacy: Foundations for a Global Engagement in the Digital Age. Thank you very much to Nick Hull and to Daniel Aguirre Azucar for joining us in this conversation about public diplomacy. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Nick Hull is Professor of Communication and Director of the Public Diplomacy Program at the University of Southern California. He is author of numerous books and articles, and notably the very recently published Public Diplomacy: Foundations for a Global Engagement in the Digital Age. Daniel Aguirre Azucar is Assistant Professor at Universidad del Desarrollo in Santiago, Chile. He has written Public Diplomacy in Latin America, an Emerging Field of Practice.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sad Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Anais Amin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.
If we want to see our world in one piece.